Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we take on the big policy crises, but we zoom right in on the human scale to give you the context you need to really get the full picture.
And today we are we're really diving into a critical story. It's a crisis that feels both huge Canada-wide and at the same time incredibly specific.
Yeah, we're looking at the intersection of Canada's housing shortage and the immense challenge of reintegrating people from the justice system.
Our focus today is landing us squarely in Atlantic Canada. Specifically, we're in Pictou County, that's spelled P-I-K-T-O-O in Nova Scotia.
See Townie.
And we're looking at the vital, and I mean really high friction, work being done there by the John Howard Society, or JHS.
And for those who might not know, the JHS is all about addressing the root causes and, the consequences of crime.
Exactly.
And our mission for this deep dive really revolves around one person on the ground there, a JHS housing worker named Corbin Naismith.
That's pronounced Corbin Naismith.
Corbin Naismith. And Corbin's task is just immense. He's trying to help formerly incarcerated men get back into the community, and he's using this globally accepted standard, the housing first approach.
But he's doing it, and this is the key, he's doing it against what is basically a perfect storm of systemic failure.
So on one side, you've got his clients.
Right. Men who desperately need stability, they need mental health and addiction support, they need a job.
And on the other side?
On the other side, he's up against a brutally tight local housing market. Severe community stigma, and just a stark, stark lack of the clinical supports they need.
So the one thing they need most, a safe, stable home, is basically impossible to find.
It's almost non-existent.
Okay, so to get everyone ready for this deep dive, we've pulled together a really wide range of sources. We're looking at international best practices.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Finland's really radical success story.
We've got national policy from the CMHC, deep research into the justice system's barriers to reentry.
And critically, we've got the local data, the numbers that show just how precarious life has become in Nova Scotia.
So our mission is to move past the single story here. We need to unpack all the systemic barriers Corbin and his clients are facing.
And we need to show how these successful models from other places could actually inform what needs to happen locally with the entire community, from, the municipal government all the way to private landlords, what they have to do.
Right, to make sure these men don't just become another invisible statistic in this growing rural homelessness crisis.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. I think we have to start with the macro environment. We have to, because Corbin's local fight in Pictou County is being just battered by this huge national structural failure.
Mm-hmm.
Canada is without a doubt in a housing supply crisis, and the scale of it, as defined by the CMHC, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, is just staggering.
Staggering is absolutely the right word. CMHC's estimate is that to restore any kind of genuine affordability across the country.
So, meaning prices actually stabilize and people at all income levels can find a place to live.
Right. To do that, we need about 5.8 million new homes built by 2030.
5.8 million. That's just an enormous figure.
It is.
So what does that actually require? I mean, in terms of action, it's not like we can just build a little bit more each year.
No. It requires a complete industrial level shift. Our current construction rates, they sit around, 200, 250,000 units a year?
Okay.
We need to nearly double that. We need to be building somewhere between 430,000 and 480,000 new units every single year until 2035 to even begin to close that gap.
And this isn't just about making housing in Toronto or Vancouver a bit cheaper. This deficit hits everywhere.
Every municipality, every town, and critically for our story, rural centers like Pictou. It limits everything. Worker mobility, economic productivity, you name it.
And the human cost of this is just this constant fear. Our sources show that a devastating 57% of Canadians now fear losing their housing if their financial situation changed, even a little.
Think about that. That's nearly 3 out of every 5 people you know, just living with that constant stress, that precarity hanging over them.
And that precarity is what we're trying to measure when we use this term core housing need. It's a technical term, but it's really simple.
It is. It just describes a household that's spending 30% or more of their before-tax income just on shelter.
Just on rent or mortgage?
Yeah. And once you hit that 30% threshold, your ability to pay for everything else, food, medicine, transportation for your kids, it's just severely compromised.
And this isn't some marginal problem, right?
Not at all. Nationally, back in 2021, over 3 million households were in that core housing need category.
Okay, let's make that real for a second. Imagine a single low-income renter in Nova Scotia. Let's say they're earning what, $30,000 a year before tax?
Which is already way below the living wage we're going to talk about later.
Way below. So their monthly income is about $2,500. 30% of that means they can only afford $750 a month for rent.
And in today's market, especially in Atlantic Canada, trying to find anything decent, anything safe for 750 is, well, it's almost impossible.
So they're forced to spend 50, maybe 60% of their income just to keep a roof over their head.
Which brings us to a really crucial policy distinction. Because while that 5.8 million homes number tells us we need more supply long term,
Right.
the immediate crisis for millions of people right now is affordability, not just availability.
What do you mean by that?
The data shows that for those 3 million households in core need, an estimated 88% of them, they're not in a bad home. They're adequately housed. They just plain can't afford the rent they're paying.
Wow. That's a huge difference in how you frame the solution.
It is.
It means that just waiting for millions of new homes to get built is just too slow. It's not a solution for the people struggling right now.
Precisely. And this is why demand-side policies, so policies that directly help with that income-to-cost mismatch, are so incredibly important as an immediate fix.
Things like income assistance or rent subsidies.
Exactly. Portable rental subsidies, the Canada Housing Benefit. These aren't just, peripheral social services. They are effective housing policy levers that can deliver immediate relief to millions way faster than any huge construction project.
But the key, I imagine, is that they have to be enough. They have to actually bridge that gap we see in places like Pictou County.
That's the challenge. They have to be sufficient.
So if we're talking about radical, successful policy shifts, we absolutely have to look overseas at what happened in Finland. It's become this global blueprint for success.
It really has. Finland just fundamentally changed its entire approach to homelessness. For decades, like most of the Western world, they operated under what's called the staircase model.
The staircase model. It's such a descriptive name.
It is.
It's this idea that housing is a privilege, right? Or some kind of eventual reward. You have to earn it.
Exactly. You start at the bottom, maybe in a shelter, and you have to climb these steps. You have to prove you're sober, stick to treatment plans, get a job, and only then are you deemed housing ready.
It treats housing as the end of this long, painful recovery process.
But the Finns realized this model was just. It was inherently flawed. It was often re-traumatizing people.
Because trying to solve incredibly complex problems like addiction or mental illness while you're also homeless.
It's virtually impossible. If you're constantly focused on just surviving, on where your next meal is or where you're going to sleep safely, you can't work on anything else. So they
Right.
flip the script.
Yeah.
Completely. They moved to the housing first philosophy.
The idea that a home should be the secure foundation, the thing that makes it easier to solve your problems, not harder.
Yes.
So what did they actually do? What were the tangible actions they took?
They made housing unconditional. They didn't wait for someone to be ready. They went out and bought existing flats. They built entirely new apartment blocks specifically for this population.
And they converted old shelters?
They converted those old institutional short-term shelters into permanent, comfortable homes. And they built the wraparound support services right into the buildings. They essentially deinstitutionalized their entire response to homelessness.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. The money, the financial side of this radical investment.
Right.
Because Finland is the only country in the entire European Union to consistently see homelessness go down since they did this decades ago. So let's talk about the cost.
Well, they spent a lot up front, about 270 million euro to buy and build the units and get the support infrastructure in place.
A big investment.
A very big investment. However, the operational savings since then have proven the model to be incredibly economically sound. They now save an estimated 15,000 euro less per year per formerly homeless person.
That's a staggering return on investment. How, I mean, where are those savings coming from?
They're realized by drastically reducing the use of incredibly expensive institutional services. Think about all the hidden costs of homelessness, the repeated emergency room visits for things that are totally preventable. Those are vastly more expensive than a community clinic visit.
Right, police time dealing with street issues, court time.
And critically, the cycles of short-term incarceration, the cost of cycling one person through jail, then a shelter, then the emergency room, and back again. It far, far outstrips the cost of just giving them stable, supported housing.
So Finland proved it. Supported housing isn't just the humane response.
It's the most fiscally responsible one.
Okay, so we've established that unconditional housing works. It saves money. It offers a path to stability. But Corbin Naismith isn't in Helsinki. He's in the Maritimes.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when this gold standard policy meets the, you know, the severe friction of Canada's tightest markets, like the one in Pictou County?
And that is the critical transferability question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Housing first in Canada, it operates on that same core philosophy. Immediate stable housing is a precondition for any other treatment.
It's an immediate rejection of the idea that someone needs to be fixed before they get a key.
Exactly.
But you can't just give someone a key and walk away, especially not Corbin's clients, who often have decades of complex, untreated issues. You need a support infrastructure.
Absolutely not. And the Canadian model requires three integrated tiers of support. First, you have what they call housing supports.
So that's the practical day-to-day stuff that Corbin is doing?
That's it. Finding a place in an impossible market, managing all the complex paperwork for rent subsidies, and this is huge, maintaining good working relationships with private landlords.
And I can imagine those landlords, especially in a smaller rural community, might have a lot of reluctance or stigma when it comes to formerly incarcerated clients. That's a huge friction point right there.
It's a massive one. The second tier is clinical supports. This is the specialized care for mental health, for addiction recovery, for physical health, all delivered in a way that respects the client's choices.
And the third?
The third is complementary supports. So things like life skills training, help navigating employment resources, fostering community engagement, all the stuff you need for sustained self-sufficiency.
And the evidence shows that when you do all three of those things, the model works here too, right? There's a big 6-year study across 5 Canadian cities.
There was. And it provided undeniable evidence that housing first is superior to what they call treatment as usual.
And for the highest needs individuals.
Especially for them. For people with complex mental health and addiction profiles, the group that got housing first maintained stable housing 85% of the time over 6 years.
85%. And the control group, the ones getting standard services.
Only 60% stability. So that 25 percentage point difference.
Okay.
That translates to thousands and thousands of fewer nights spent on the street or cycling through jail.
The conclusion is just inescapable. The model works.
It works.
But, and this is a huge but, we keep hitting this wall of practical reality. The success of Housing First relies heavily on rent supplements, on making sure the client only pays 30% of their income.
And for that, you need units that are actually accessible and available. When Corbin is trying to find a place in a market that has virtually zero vacancies, where costs are just soaring,
the whole philosophy breaks down.
It's fundamentally undermined. The model relies on leveraging existing private rentals. But if JHS can't find a landlord willing to take a subsidized client because there are 20 other tenants offering cash for the same unit, the model just fails instantly.
It needs a massive concurrent investment in building new affordable housing supply.
It absolutely does.
Which brings us, with some pretty sobering clarity, to the immense challenges facing Corbin Naismith and the formerly incarcerated men he serves in Pictou County.
Yes. The barriers these men face when they try to reenter the community are, they're immediate and they're severe, and they're driven by this systemic intersection of the justice system and housing precarity.
When a man walks out of a correctional facility, finding a roof over his head is often the single biggest predictor of whether he's going to succeed or fail.
And the odds are just heavily stacked against them from day one. Our sources show that formerly incarcerated men face more than twice the odds of experiencing homelessness compared to men without that history.
For more than twice, that's not an anecdote. That's a measurable statistical penalty the system imposes on them.
It is. And housing is just. It's the precondition for any other kind of stability. You can't look for a job. You can't maintain your recovery treatment. You can't report to your parole officer successfully if you don't even know where you're going to sleep tonight.
Former inmates themselves have pointed this out. There's a quote in the research. We are failing these people because they are not getting the help they need housing.
And tragically, the system itself often actively manufactures this instability. It does it through these punitive policies. We see it with federal one-strike policies, especially in public housing.
What's a one-strike policy?
It means that even a minor violation, often something related to their trauma or mental health, can lead to an immediate and permanent eviction.
So just when they've achieved some fragile stability, they're catapulted straight back into homelessness.
Instantly. Beyond just eviction, we have to look at the severe co-occurrence of substance use and mental health challenges in this population. These are issues that are often untreated or even made worse by being incarcerated.
The data on substance use is just chilling. Among people who die from accidental acute toxicity, which is a tragic measure of the addiction crisis, those without housing have higher histories of substance use than those who are housed. It's 92% versus 83%.
So the population Corbin is serving is at extremely high risk. They're managing chronic substance use issues, often rooted in really deep trauma.
And the stress of being incarcerated, plus the lack of access to consistent quality treatment while they're inside. It means that for individuals with mental illnesses, their conditions often get worse.
They do. And when they're released, they need specialized, individualized supports to have any chance of reintegrating. A generic one-size-fits-all model just won't work for someone managing severe anxiety, PTSD, or a substance dependency that was triggered by institutional life.
And this is where we run into a major failing of the release process itself.
A huge failing.
The release planning, which is supposed to coordinate all these specialized services, is often just insufficient. And this brings us to a vital concept that needs so much more attention. Through care.
Through care. It's the principle that the services that are started during incarceration, whether it's mental health counseling, addiction programming, education, they have to be seamlessly continued when the person returns to the community.
So it's the opposite of just cutting off all services at the prison gate.
Exactly. It recognizes that any clinical gains you make inside are completely meaningless if the entire support structure just evaporates the second that person is released.
So what does a lack of through care practically mean for one of Corbin's clients? Someone who might be dealing with an opioid addiction and severe depression.
It means they lose their counselor. They lose their medication continuity. They lose their only consistent source of structure. And then they're just dropped into this environment, the scarcity of Pictou County, where housing is a fight and a job is nearly impossible.
The stress and the trauma of that abandonment, it has to lead directly to relapse and reoffending.
Instantly. A lack of through care directly fuels higher rates of homelessness and reincarceration. We are essentially decommissioning a person's recovery efforts at the exact moment they need its support the most.
So even if Corbin manages the impossible and finds stable housing, and he coordinates some form of clinical through care, the client still hits this ultimate barrier, finding a job and facing that wall of stigma.
Employment barriers are a layered disaster. Many of these men already face challenges, low literacy, no professional qualifications, a spotty employment history, but that is minor compared to the sheer volume of employer discrimination they face.
What does the research say? How widespread is this discrimination?
Our sources indicate that about half of employers are likely to reject a job applicant just because they have a criminal record.
Half. Even for jobs where the record isn't even relevant.
Even then.
Yeah.
And if the conviction is perceived as serious, even if it's decades old, the rejection rate for applicants can skyrocket to 90% of available jobs.
So when you factor that in, plus the low wages available in rural Nova Scotia, a client's ability to find meaningful, sustained employment that pays anywhere near a living wage becomes statistically almost impossible.
It does. And this makes the entire reintegration effort dependent on coordinated system support, not just the individual's willpower.
And this is why the research on successful reentry programs all points to the need for true partnerships.
Yes. And not just in a handshake or a logo on a website. We're talking about partnerships that operate consistently at three critical levels.
What are they?
First, policy development. So actually changing the rules, like those exclusionary one-strike policies. Second, operational practice, which means standardizing how agencies share information and refer clients. And third, staff decision-making.
So training correctional staff, community probation officers, and JHS workers like Corbin to all use the same trauma-informed housing-first protocols.
Exactly. So everyone is speaking the same language.
And for all of this complex coordination to actually work, someone needs to be driving the bus.
Absolutely. The research highlights the absolute necessity of a full-time project director. They call this person a boundary spanner.
A boundary spanner. I like that.
Their whole job is to sit between all these siloed organizations, corrections, government ministries, NGOs like JHS, the private sector, and force them to align their goals towards this collective mission.
A mission of public safety through successful reintegration.
Without that coordination and leadership, the system just defaults to its natural state, which is silos and failure.
So the story of Corbin in Pictou County is really the story of that sustained engagement against just immense friction.
It is. It's a microcosm of what happens when national policies aren't funded or coordinated properly at the local level. And that effort is what allows the individual to invest in their new identity.
Because Successful reintegration, as the research notes, is a long-term process. It's about assuming the identity of a changed person.
Someone committed to their job, to their family, to their community. And without that stable housing foundation, that investment in social capital just collapses instantly, which leads right back to reoffense.
Okay, so we've set the national stage and the specific hurdles for Corbin's clients. Now let's zoom in on the specific geography of Atlantic Canada, because these challenges aren't just amplified there, they are accelerating at a really shocking pace.
Mm-hmm. Nova Scotia is facing a level of precarity that I think is often overlooked when the national media is focused on Toronto and Vancouver.
Right.
Back in 2018, 11.4% of Nova Scotian households were already in core housing need. That was slightly higher than the national average at the time. And crucially, the overwhelming majority of those households were renters.
And if you look just at the low-income renter population, the situation goes from precarious to, well, to impossible.
It does. The data shows that 69% of low-income renters in Nova Scotia spend 30% or more of their income on shelter.
69%. That's severe acute unaffordability. And it's concentrated among the very people Corbin Naismith is serving.
And this crisis links directly to income inadequacy in the region. To understand why those housing supplements are so vital, you have to look at the income someone actually needs to live safely.
The living wage.
Right. The calculated 2025 living wage for the northern region of Nova Scotia, which includes Pictou County, is $25.50 an hour.
$25.50 an hour. That's the minimum a family needs to afford the basics, rent, food, childcare, without relying on government subsidies.
Now, compare that to Corbin's clients, who are lucky if they can find a minimum wage job, which is often half that rate.
If they can find work at all.
Exactly. When your wages fall that drastically short of what's required for secure living, housing insecurity isn't just a possibility, it's a mathematical certainty.
The affordability gap is just too massive. It makes the job of a housing first worker exponentially harder.
It does. Even with a 30% rent supplement, if the market rate is too high, that supplement has to be huge, which puts an enormous strain on the GHS budget.
And this precarity in the rural communities often leads to people moving to find services, which is why we have to use Halifax the HRM as a kind of indicator for the whole region's stress level.
We do. Even though Pictou County is a good 2-hour drive away, the data coming out of Halifax is genuinely alarming. It paints a picture of regional systemic failure.
Okay, what are the numbers?
The total count of people experiencing homelessness in the HRM spiked by 93% in just 2 years.
Wait, 93%? In 2 years?
Yes. It went from 586 people in 2022 to 1,132 people in 2024. It nearly doubled.
That's catastrophic.
It is. And if you zoom out even further, that's a 414% increase in homelessness over just 6 years, since 2018. This system is clearly overwhelmed.
And you can see it on the streets, right?
Absolutely. Halifax is seeing a huge increase in people sheltering outside, a 500% increase between 2019 and 2023. This is the visible evidence of a crisis that is consuming the entire region.
And how is this dramatic surge impacting the local political and social climate?
It's fueling intense NMBism. Not in my backyard opposition. Community opposition in Halifax is raising these concerns that the crisis is getting worse because of migration.
Migration from where?
From other parts of the province. Hmm. They specifically cite rural areas like Truro, New Glasgow, Cape Breton, people moving to the capital because they're seeking better, more centralized access to resources and services.
So Halifax is effectively absorbing the stress and the systemic failure of support services in all the surrounding rural communities.
Precisely. And that migration dynamic relates directly to the lack of infrastructure available for Corbin's clients back in Pictou.
Which leads us to the critical but often unseen crisis in places like Pictou County itself. Because unlike the visible encampments in Halifax, rural homelessness is largely invisible.
It is.
What does that mean? How is it different from the urban problem?
It's characterized by extremely high mobility, an extensive reliance on really precarious temporary arrangements. We call it couch surfing.
Right, staying with friends or family until you wear out your welcome.
Until those social networks are completely exhausted, people residing in cars and old campers in abandoned buildings, anything to avoid the high visibility of street homelessness, which carries even greater safety risks in a small community where everyone knows you.
And because these rural locations often don't have dedicated services like big shelters or street outreach teams, it's incredibly difficult to even count the problem.
You can't count what you can't see. And that difficulty in counting the problem makes it so much harder to secure resources for it.
So researchers have to rely on other data.
They rely on proxy data, those high rates of poverty and core housing need we talked about. And that research suggests that housing instability in rural settings might be just as common, or maybe even higher, than in urban settings.
And this lack of infrastructure directly impacts the John Howard Society's ability to help a newly released client who has literally nowhere to go.
Think about it. If a formerly incarcerated man is released into the northern region of Nova Scotia, near Pictou County, the official emergency shelters are Viola's Place in New Glasgow or the YMCA Stellar House in Stellarton.
But those places aren't right there.
They are 53 to 56 kilometers away from Pictou itself.
That's a huge distance if you have no car, no money.
It's an insurmountable barrier. So that geographical distance plus the complexity of trying to coordinate services across these sparse rural populations means that support just defaults back to those informal social networks, the friends and family we mentioned.
Which, if the client has complex needs, are going to be exhausted very quickly.
Inevitably. And when those informal supports collapse, these highly vulnerable men who are already grappling with intense stigma, no job, unresolved mental health and addiction issues, they are at extreme risk.
I enter that invisible cycle of rural homelessness.
Or inevitably, they migrate to Halifax and they add to the strain there, compounding the regional crisis. Corbin Nysmith's tireless work is, in many cases, the only thing standing between these men and that fate.
So, given all these systemic constraints, the national supply shortage, the crippling regional poverty, the rural invisibility, the pervasive stigma, what are the actionable steps? What systemic changes can we identify from our sources that would actually support Corbin's mission on the ground in Pictou County?
I think we have to start by making sure the support systems that do exist are actually aligned with the Housing First philosophy. And that means tackling the barriers to access that currently exclude the most vulnerable people.
So you're talking about transitional housing facilities that have strict rules.
Exactly. Many of them, even if they're well-meaning, they use abstinence-based models or they exclude people with acute mental health challenges.
Which means they're essentially failing the highest needs group that the JHS is mandated to serve.
They are. Best practice demands a low-barrier approach. Housing has to be offered without preconditions about sobriety or treatment compliance. And critically, no one should ever be discharged from a program back into homelessness.
Ever, regardless of program violations.
That low-barrier philosophy is the backbone of Corbin's efforts. It's all about sustained engagement.
And what does sustained engagement mean in the long term for a client who has lifelong complex needs?
It means accepting that long-term support, maybe even lifetime support, might be required to maintain that housing security.
And the crucial practical element here must be the rent assistance.
It's the portability of rental assistance. If a client successfully moves from a supportive housing unit into a private rental, they cannot lose their subsidy the moment they exit the program.
Because if they do, the affordability gap immediately swallows them and they're right back where they started.
Instantly. Portability is the key to sustained affordability.
And building on that personalized support, we have to recognize the deep history of trauma this population carries.
Absolutely. We have to embed trauma and violence-informed approaches into every single level of policy and practice.
Which means creating universal trauma precautions.
Yes. It's not just about treating symptoms. It's about recognizing that high-risk individuals with histories of violence and substance abuse are often reacting to deep, unprocessed trauma. This requires consistent integrated services and a universally safe, predictable response from every agency Corbin has to deal with.
Okay, so we need better support models. But that still leaves the fundamental physical problem, the lack of available, affordable units in the Pictou area for these men to even move into.
Mm-hmm.
This requires provincial and municipal action to increase supply. What are the most powerful levers Nova Scotia can pull right now?
The most immediate and probably the most politically contentious is zoning reform. Municipalities in Nova Scotia are still burdened by these restrictive, exclusionary zoning rules.
Can you break down exclusionary zoning for us? What does that actually look like in a town like Pictou?
Exclusionary zoning is just the set of rules that dictates what you can build on a piece of land. And typically, it limits vast swaths of residential areas to single-family homes only.
So it makes it illegal to build lower-cost, medium-density housing.
Exactly. To support the missing middle. So housing types like duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, municipalities have to update these rules. They need to allow these types of units to be built as of right on residential lots without needing costly, time-consuming public hearings or special variances.
So a lot that currently has a singles house could legally accommodate a fourplex without years of bureaucratic red tape, which would immediately increase the potential supply of affordable units for organizations like JHS.
That's the goal. And beyond just simple reform, municipalities should be strategically increasing height and density near key infrastructure.
What does the CMHC recommend?
The recommendations are clear. Allow a minimum of 4 stories within 800 meters of main transit routes or post-secondary institutions. You leverage public investment to maximize housing potential in high-demand areas.
And what about addressing the national construction bottleneck? How do we get housing built faster, especially in rural areas where skilled trades might be scarce?
This is where innovative construction techniques become absolutely crucial. Provincial and federal policy has to strongly encourage and prioritize modular and prefabricated housing.
Because they can be built much faster.
30 to 50% faster than traditional stick-built homes. It minimizes disruption and it accelerates deployment. To really unlock this, governments need to shift their procurement models toward industrialized construction by default.
So prioritizing long-term value and speed over just the lowest upfront bid.
Right. This would allow smaller organizations like the JHS to partner with builders who can rapidly deploy supportive units.
That sounds powerful. But even with faster construction, affordable housing projects often fail the financial viability test. What financial policies can governments use to make these projects actually work for nonprofits?
Two main things. First, tax policy. Governments should waive development charges, those are the fees on new construction, and property taxes for affordable housing projects that are guaranteed to stay affordable for, say, 40 years.
That would lower the construction costs significantly.
Massively. And second, land policy. Provincial and federal governments are sitting on surplus land. Repurposing that land and making it available at zero cost to nonprofit housing developers is maybe the single greatest subsidy a government can provide. It dramatically improves the project economics.
These are all necessary structural solutions, but they all crash into that final, deeply entrenched obstacle, stigma, community opposition, and NIMBYism.
Absolutely. The fear of having formerly incarcerated men placed in your neighborhood.
NIMBYism is complex, right? It's not just one thing.
It's often broken down into 4 categories. Economic, so fear of reduced property values.
Yeah.
Political, which is mistrust in government. Spatial, which is about preserving neighborhood character, and social.
And for Corbyn's clients, it's the social component that's the most damaging.
It is. It's rooted in fear. The fear of crime, perpetuated by stereotypes of poverty and criminality. A truly holistic approach to housing recognizes that communities have the power to either include or isolate people.
If the community reacts with fear and rejection, the man's chances of sustained recovery just plummet, no matter how good his rent supplement is.
The system fails him again, just on a social level.
So Corbyn's mission and the success of the JHS really relies on converting skeptical neighbors into supportive community members.
It requires proactive engagement to directly address those social concerns and normalize the transition. This is why the sources stress the necessity of those true partnerships we talked about.
Right.
JHS needs that formal and informal alignment with community groups, local government, the private sector. And that boundary spanner is essential here, coordinating policy changes with staff-level outreach to make sure the community understands that successful reintegration is the most effective form of public safety.
Let's just challenge that for a moment. If the community in Pictou County sees these men struggling, maybe they relapse or they're dealing with an acute mental health episode because recovery isn't a straight line, doesn't that validate the NIMBY concerns about safety? What does Housing First offer to address that inevitable friction?
And that's where the support component of Housing First is absolutely paramount. Housing First doesn't promise immediate perfection. It promises stability. The support teams that are integrated into the model, the clinical and complementary supports, they're designed to manage relapses and crises in the community, not in the hospital or in a jail cell.
So the community is actually safer.
The community is safer when a person relapses in a stable, supported apartment where services can be dispatched immediately, rather than on the street where the outcome is unpredictable and often tragic. It shifts the burden from emergency services back to preventative care.
So it's an ongoing education process for the community.
Showing them that having resources readily available is what actually ensures local safety.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, Corbyn's goal isn't just about rehabilitation for one person. It's a critical component of regional public safety and community health.
Absolutely. Successful reintegration, supported by housing and robust services, dramatically reduces recidivism. The cost of a failed reintegration, a return to crime, addiction, incarceration, is borne by the entire community, and it far outweighs the cost of the supported housing. It just requires coordinated leadership to realize that.
This deep dive has really shown us that the challenge Kirbin Naismith faces in Pictou County is this direct intersection of global policy success. The urgent need for housing, first meeting Canada's acute national housing supply crisis, and the severe regional poverty and stigma of rural Nova Scotia.
We've seen that the success of reintegrating men after incarceration hinges entirely on system-wide investment and coordination. It is not just about an individual's commitment.
No, it's about governments removing administrative barriers, scrapping those punitive one-strike policies, enacting mandatory zoning reform, providing sustained portable rental assistance that actually bridges that massive living wage gap.
And the invisibility of rural homelessness in northern Nova Scotia means that communities like Pictou County have to actively seek out and address this instability rather than just waiting for the crisis to become visible on the streets of Halifax.
Right. Having a shelter 50 kilometers away is fundamentally insufficient when local support networks are exhausted and affordable housing is non-existent.
But there is a clear roadmap to success. We know that one Canadian city, Medicine Hat, Alberta, functionally ended chronic homelessness. They did it by implementing a highly coordinated, data-driven system. It proves this is achievable, even in the Canadian context.
It wasn't just abstract policy, it was applied political and operational will.
Exactly.
Which leaves us with a final, provocative thought for you to consider. We've established the enormous cost savings that come from housing-first models globally. Institutional responses cycling people through jails, courts, psychiatric care can cost well over $200 a day per person.
And we know that supported housing options are demonstrably less expensive and more humane.
So if the total aggregated costs of managing chronic homelessness are significantly and demonstrably higher than the investment needed to provide stable, supported housing, what deeper societal assumptions are stopping us? Assumptions about worthiness, maybe about punishment, or perhaps just a fundamental lack of political courage when it comes to things like necessary zoning reform. What is preventing us from accelerating the investment needed to make Kirbin's tireless individual mission the accepted, profitable, and humane societal norm?